Andrew Peterson, one of the best singers and songwriters around. Just got to see if he's got any new music. Haven't heard anything new from Andrew in a while. Rise and Shine, the name of the song. We heard from the Sweet Comfort Band by special request. Childish Things. We heard from the Annie Moses Band, too, in My Room. It is 14 minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark, good friend of the station, the only biochemist we have on staff here, and he's coming to us from Garden Valley, Texas, where he raises grapes and basks in the sunshine. And you're involved in a number of different ministries, though, or even from there, because Garden Valley is the location for lots of them, huh? Christian ministries.
Well, there's quite a few Christian ministries around here. Well, there's Mercy Ships, there's YWAM, Youth with Mission, there was Teen Mania, but they moved to Dallas over the past year or so. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's quite a few mission organizations. I used to be involved with Mercy Ships. I'm not involved with them anymore, but I am involved with some folks that were part of Mercy Ships with me. So we have an organization called Orphan Relief and Rescue, which back in 2010, we moved the organization from here actually to Seattle, because the folks who co-founded the organization wanted to move back to Seattle. So that's where the organization now resides.
And now, and you're active in a prison ministry as well.
Yes, we do. We do a program called Malachi Dads, which actually is a program of Awana Lifeline. And it helps to, the purpose of the program is to bring the hearts of the fathers to their children and the children's hearts back to the fathers. They also have another program called Hannah's Gift, which does the same thing for women in prison. Okay. So there are, it's a biblically based curriculum that we do, and we teach men how to be
this involves visits to the inmates in the prisons, doesn't it?
Yes, we typically go. Well, of course, we're kind of on a hiatus right at the moment, but we would typically go every Sunday, Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, and spend about 2 hours with the inmates, about 30 minutes of kind of a class lecture type of thing, and then we would break up into small groups. And then have a discussion of the lesson for the day, as well as hear any concerns or try to work through any issues that
do you get to meet. Do you get to meet one-on-one with some of the inmates then, and deal with their specific issues and needs and thoughts?
Well, what happens is that in the small groups, you actually form a pretty tight-knit the group of inmates. Typically, inmates don't trust anybody, but after being in this program for a while, they begin to trust each other, and issues begin to surface, and inmates help inmates, sometimes because they've experienced the same thing and have resolved the issue for themselves, and then are more in a position to help other inmates in that situation. In which case, we act as a facilitator and make sure things don't get off course, and we try to stick to the curriculum and what we're teaching at the time.
You sound like a very busy person. Do you ever feel like you're spread too thin? I mean, between that and you're a board member of Creation Moments, that takes some time, and you've been traveling to Russia and to Cuba on behalf of other ministries. So, yeah, when do you get to be a biochemist and make wine?
During the week. I mean, the week is very busy, too. Yeah.
Now, the point being that the Dr. Don is a very giving guy and with a heart of gold, and he walks the walk, and we're so pleased to have him here every Tuesday morning. We talk about things scientific normally. It's faith and creation and science and rigid rules and faulty assumptions. We do that. We talk about that a lot. And the topic today, it comes from an article over at the Institute for Creation Research, which is based in Dallas, by the way, isn't it?
Yes, it is. They used to be in El Cajon, California, but several years ago they moved the organization to Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, okay. Well, we've talked about how old things are dated here many times, and this is kind of a new wrinkle because for the longest time, scientists have had difficulty dating things that are older than 50,000 years, you know, by their estimate, by their other methods. Then that's, name some of those. There's carbon 14. What other kinds of dating methods do they have?
Oh, there's a bunch. There's potassium argon, for example. Any you can take any radioactive, theoretically, you can take any radioactive element and do a dating with it, assuming you can measure it. It's in large enough quantities to measure. But the concept is that you have a radioactive unstable element, for example, and it degrades into something. Uranium, for example, ultimately degrades into lead, but there's several degradation products along the way. Polonium is one of them. So you're dating. What you're trying to do is figure out. Okay, I think I started with this much radioactive. Let's take argon potassium. I started with this much potassium initially, radioactive potassium, and it then is going to degrade into, let's say, argon, and then I know how much potassium I currently have, and I know how much argon I currently have in this rock. And so I'm assuming, based on the degradation rate, that everything was potassium initially, and it all degraded. What I'm seeing as far as argon is, how much...
And somehow they've determined what this rate is. And that's known as what? The half-life.
The half-life of the element. And the same thing with carbon-14, for example.
And they call it the half-life.
Carbon-14 is radioactive. Carbon-12 is stable. Mm-hmm. Carbon-14 degrades to nitrogen-14. And so you look at that. And what determines how useful a particular element, radioactive element, is for a half-life as far as how far back you can date, depends on the half-life. And so if the half-life is short, like carbon-14, then after 10 half-lives, for example, you don't have much of the original radioactive carbon-14
left.
Okay,
so there's half as much as there was, and there's half of that, and then there's half of that, and then there's half. Soon you can't measure it.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that gets us to about 50,000 years with carbon-14. But these other elements, for example... get you, because they have much longer half-lives, then you can date, further. But sometimes the half-life is so slow that it takes a long time before you start building up any of the degradation products, for example.
Can scientists take anything, animal, vegetable, or mineral, and date it this way?
Well, if it's organic, they typically use carbon-14. Now, if it's like rocks or mineral, for example, and there's crystals in the rocks, then they would use some other technique, like I mentioned, to date the rocks.
A longer half-life element they would be looking for.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now then enters thermal,
or because there's no carbon in the sample,
which means it's older than 50,000. If they can't measure any carbon 14, they figure it's got to be older than 50,000 years or thereabouts. But why not 48,000 years, or 35,000 years? How does this number? How do they arrive at 50,000 years?
Oh, well, it's just mathematical. It's basically after a certain, like I said, after a certain number of half-lives, mm-hmm. In this case, you know, the carbon-14, I believe, has a half-life of like 5,000 years. And so 10 half-lives gives you 50,000 years.
Okay. Now, isn't it possible that over time, with increasing technology and know-how, that they could maybe measure smaller and smaller amounts of carbon-14 so that the old method would become obsolete and they could maybe take it back farther than 50,000 years? Or is that kind of an absolute?
It's not absolute, because they've already done that. We've actually did a program sometime. Mm-hmm. It's been about 2 years, maybe even 3 years ago, where we discussed radioactive dating in detail. And, I mean, you know, you could push it to 60,000 or so, depending on your detection methods. Mm-hmm. And some methods these days are obviously more sensitive than they were you know, several years ago when they first tried to start doing this. At some point, there's so much noise in your signal, regardless of how precise your instrument is, that you just run into, you know, kind of background noise.
Now, without getting too technical, how do they measure this? How do they identify carbon-14, say? Is it like a mass spectrograph? They spin the stuff and they shine light through it, or a laser, and they see the colors. How does that happen? don't get too technical on me here.
You can use mass specs, and there's different types of mass specs that will give you what is a mass spec? Well, a mass spec separates. It's a mass spectrometer, so it separates the compounds and the elements, let's say, in your sample into the individual elements, and so you can measure the quantity of those elements. Individual. You put it in the machine. It burns it or heats it up, and then excites it, and then passes it through a magnetic field. And the magnetic field is what separates the elements into their various elements. And then you look at the blip on your detector, and you figure out, well, how much area is under the blip, and that's how much material that you have in your sample.
Okay. Now, if I had a pottery sample from ancient Egypt, and I wanted to date it, and then the process you just described looks like a 20% error is acceptable. I mean, if it between 50,000 and 60,000 years, depends upon your techniques and other things, wouldn't I want to submit this maybe to several labs and get an average? Is that how they do it, or do they go with one and take their chances? Because it sounds kind of iffy to me.
Well, it is. You're not going to get a precise. Here's the problem with all of these dating techniques. And one is you're assuming that the half-life remains constant or has remained constant throughout history. Mm-hmm. We have now, you know, found that, well, maybe that assumption isn't correct. If the half-life doesn't remain constant, then regardless of how accurate you can measure the individual elements, whether it be carbon or potassium or, you know, any other of the radioisotopes that are used, you don't know what your end result is. Because if the half-life, let's say, fluctuates by 25%, and you don't know if you're dealing with a half-life that has slowed down or a half-life that has speeded up sometime in the past, then you don't know what your date is.
It would seem that half-lives are determined somewhat by environment, by external radiation sources, for example, and temperature and maybe even humidity and moisture, things like that would tend to alter the half-life.
Well, the half-life has to do with the strong nuclear forces within the element, which is a whole nother topic. But and you know, they thought, well, the strong nuclear forces, they're so strong that nothing can perturb them. But I think they're finding now that, hey, even the solar radiation that hits the Earth can affect the half-lives of these elements, and then some elements are more susceptible to this solar radiation. I don't think heat by itself, at least to my knowledge, now, you know, maybe somebody in our audience might know, but heating an element up may not, you know, change or perturb the half-life. You'd have to, I would guess, really get it hot in order to begin to affect the half-life. But there are some things, like I said, like perhaps solar radiation, that can begin to affect these half-lives. So if your half-life changes, then you've got a problem.
Okay, now here's a related question. If the half-life of carbon-14 is 10,000 years, is that determined by formula? Because no one was around 10,000 years ago to say, okay, here's our starting point. Now measure this, you guys, 10,000 years in the future, and see where it is. I mean, it had to be from a formula of some kind or an extrapolation.
Oh, extrapolation. Well, the decay formulas are quite well known.
We have confidence in them, huh?
The formula. I mean, yeah. It's just an exponential decay. I mean, it can be easily derived. The mathematics is simple. It's the obviously, if you the longer the half-life, the longer you have to wait. I mean, you take a sample, in this case, carbon-14, and you measure it over a period of time, and you see the decay in the carbon-14. Now, you don't have to wait, you know, for the half-life. You just wait, you know, for a period of time so that you have a good enough data that you can begin to define that degradation curve.
But again, this is only a valid process if the rate is constant. If the rate is unpredictable, you're back to square one.
You are, because you know, obviously the degradation is going to change, mm-hmm, based on the rate. That's, you know, that's one form of error. We talked about you know, the error that's in measuring the elements in the, mm-hmm, first place. One of the problems with dating something, let's say, that's in between, well, I can date this with carbon-14, which is going to get me to 50 to 60,000 years, but this thing that I want to date, for example, is in between the 50,000 years and in between the millions of years that I use with these other techniques, mm-hmm, these other, you know, radiation radioisotopes. So how do I date it if it's beyond the carbon-14, but it's also under, for example, some of these other radioisotope techniques that I know it's not, you know, 50, 60 million years old, but it's got to be between the 50,000 years and the 60, you know, million years. Mm-hmm. That's where a conundrum, I mean, excluding everything that we just talked about, that's where, you know, things have, it was really real iffy until relatively recent, when they came up with a new technique, and that technique is thermoluminescence dating. That they hoped would solve the problem, for example, of trying to date like a piece of pottery that's been in the ground a certain number of years. They think that it's older than 50,000 years, but not as old as, let's say, 50 million years. So I want to get a date that's somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is the thermoluminescent dating technique that they use? Well, the piece of pottery is in the earth, and the earth has a residual radiation. For example, it's got background radiation, and we're bombarded by this background radiation, you know, every day. Of course, the sun's giving off radiation, and that's what's kind of feeding the earth with its radiation. And so when you bury something, then the earth, then the surrounding earth or dirt in this case can give off its radiation to the object that's buried. In this case, it's pottery. And since pottery is a solid, it's got crystal material in it. Obviously, there is silicone and there's glass, for example, and because it's, you know, made with dirt itself and heated, and it's melted together. But there's, you know, there's other different types of elements in there besides silicon dioxide, like lithium, for example, and other elements. Well, these elements, these crystallized elements, for example, are capable of picking up this radiation and kind of storing it, you know, for a while until you excite the crystal. And so it picks up the radiation, and it picks it up in the electrons of these elements, and it excites the electrons. So it puts the electrons in a higher energy state, if you will. So you can take the pottery out of the ground, and you say, "I want to know how old this piece of pottery is." So you can do a number of things. You can say, well, if I assume that the radiation dose rate is this, because I've measured it, and so if the pottery's been in X amount of in the ground X amount of time, then based on this kind of average dose rate, then if I can get the energy out of these, you know, like lithium crystals or lithium or other elements, if I can get the energy out of that and then measure that energy, then I can know how long that piece of pottery was in the ground.
Okay, now question right at this point. When you apply this method to this piece of pottery, are you getting the age of the pottery once it became pottery, or are you getting the age of the elements once they were formed?
You're getting the age of the pottery once it was buried, because it depends on being buried in the ground.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So, you know, the pottery could be around for, you know, a number of years. Yeah, and then,
this could be quite useful, because pottery is one of the primary forms of evidence for civilizations for dating back 2,000-4,000 years. So, you know, if this works, this could be very helpful, I can see. I mean, pottery's all over the place in the Middle East in particular. Biblical times, I'm thinking here.
Yep, yeah. Mm-hmm. So you could say, well, this civilization's been around, you know, for X thousands of years based on this technique. So anyway, you've got these excited electrons in these elements, and you want to get it out. So how do you get them out? How do you de-excite those? Well, you either heat it up or you shoot a laser at it, which kind of jolts these electrons, and it causes the electrons to fall back into a more stable state. And when the electrons fall back into a less excited state, they give off what's commonly called light. Mm-hmm. And it's the same kind of technique that's used in a fluorescent bulb, for example. But you're doing just the opposite. You're using current to excite neon, for electrons in neon, and then the excited electrons in neon fall back down, and it gives off life at a certain frequency. Well, the same thing is done here. And so all you then need to do is measure how much light is given off. And that is a very, can be a very precise technique, because we've been measuring light for a long time. And so they measure the amount of light and they say, aha, that's the amount of excited electrons we had originally in the pottery. And based on our radiation dose rate, we can then calculate an age for this piece of pottery.
But this system, this technique, thermoluminescent dating, seems to be subject to the same kind of assumptive errors that are the other methods. I mean, there's still underlying assumptions that, that we can't be totally sure of.
Well, there are a lot of assumptions in this technique, just like there's a lot of assumptions in all the dating techniques. The major assumption, of course, is that the radiation in the ground, in the radiation dose rate, for example, the amount of radiation that's there is constant. And we know that that changes with solar energy. It changes between night and day, for example. It changes with season. It changes with location, you know, around the Earth. So just because you have a rate right where you're standing, it doesn't necessarily mean that that rate is going to be constant between the, like I said, day and night, or from the seasons, one season to the next, or from one location to the other.
And what would
the
happen-
other problem oh, go ahead. I'm that sorry. You have is that different elements in the pottery absorb this energy differently. And unless you analyze and really get into a very, very complicated analysis of taking apart the piece of pottery and isolating out the various elements, and then measuring each of the elements for this trapped energy, for example, you might have one piece of pottery that has more lithium 6, for example, than another piece of pottery that might have more lithium 7. Well, lithium 6 reacts differently than lithium 7. And so those are two different isotopes of lithium. And so just the same element, but two different isotopes are absorbing this energy differently. And you know, so you can get a different answer just based on the amount of ratio of the lithium 6 to lithium 7. So there's a number of places for, you know, possible errors in this technique. But all of this, all of these dating techniques assume a deep time assumption. That is, that we are assuming that the Earth and the universe was formed billions upon billions of years ago. Well, the Earth millions upon millions, you know, 4.5 billion years ago, as opposed to, you know, millions of years or 18, you know, billion years, as opposed to the, or, you know, the universe, for example. Well, what if that's not the case? What if the Bible is actually accurate and is a historical record, and you know, the Earth was formed 6,000 years ago? Then all of these dating techniques are kind of out the window, because they're inaccurate by not only hundreds of thousands of years, but millions of years. And so your assumption is completely wrong, and therefore the conclusions that you based those assumptions on are absolutely wrong, and your dates that you come up with are absolutely wrong. So take the case of the pottery. You're looking for a how old did this civilization live? Well, if you get an answer of saying, well, that was 70,000 years ago, that answer is wrong, because we know, at least biblically, that the flood was a little over 4,400 years ago. And so any civilization that lived post-flood has got to be less than 4,400 years.
Well, the crux of this whole thing is that these scientific dating methods do not hold up under intense scrutiny because of those assumptions. And while science has so much invested in them, and I mean, they really earnestly try, they want to know the age of these things, it's kind of like grasping at straws. Well, we got to have something to hold on to. Let's go with this theory, and we'll have to just presume that it's true, and it's right, and it's accurate for all time. Because without that, we've got nothing to go on.
Well, you do have something to go on, but they don't want to admit that they have something to go on. That's the historical record.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the historical written record, that is, of mankind. You know, the more, here's the thing. I mean, the more you delve into the Bible and the more you read it and you study it and you look at the evidence that's around the world, you know, the more you conclude that, not only is the Bible a decent history book, it is a very accurate history book. And there are things in it that, you know, could not have been predicted, but because it also contains, prophecy, you can look back and say, okay, this particular prophet, for example, he was given a message to say that this particular event is going to happen at this particular time. And lo and behold, you go, because that event is now past, you can go back and look at the prophecy and say, is it accurate? Well, it turns out there are some prophecies that are accurate to the day. And this was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years in the past that the prophecy was given before the prophecy actually turned, you know, came true. So no other book in the world and no other has this type of accuracy. But again and again, we choose to ignore it. We choose to ignore that evidence, and then we try to come up with techniques. And they're decent scientific attempts to try to get at this data, but in the absence of historical data, historical reliable data, that is or record, I should say, you're kind of grasping at straws, and you're coming up with your own theories, because certainly God could not create, you know, the universe and create the world and create man and create everything in it. Certainly, you know, a God wasn't involved, because if there was a God involved, then I might be accountable to that God. And therein lies, mm-hmm. you know, the problem.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. It's a philosophical problem then, and a spiritual problem. But calling out actual evidence and then making a decision seems to be pretty risky science. And the thing that impresses me about you, Dr. Don, and Creation Moments and the Institute for Creation Research is it talks about science from outside the Bible. I mean, we're just talking about pure science that supports the biblical story. And it's exposed to so few people and in so few scientific journals, in so few classrooms, that it gets buried and hence ignored. And that's what I know you are dedicated to fighting, as is Creation Moments and the Institute for Creation Research. And we're just tickled here that we can give it some attention, too. I want to point out to people that there is a website, creationmoments.com, that you can visit and find lots more writings and videos and accounts, scientific accounts of this evidence. And it's fascinating stuff to see how it conforms to what we consider to be biblical truths. I mean, true is true, whether it comes from history or from science. And when the two meet up, it's pretty energizing. It's pretty amazing, wonderful stuff. And we see it time and again here when actual scientific, valid scientific work conforms to what the Bible tells us. And
we
go ahead, Dave.
Go ahead.
No.
Yeah, I interrupted your thought. I'm sorry.
That's right. My thought is now gone.
Is it? Did I kill it?
Down the drain. Yep.
Should I stomp on it first?
No. Just go ahead.
It's history. It's gone.
Just tell me what you were thinking, David.
It's over. I wonder. You know, when this belief or this challenge of biblical truth started, or this straying from, you know, what you refer to many times, because I think I remember reading of the 16th, 17th, 18th century scientists and speakers being very much attuned to what you're talking about, that you're looking at the Bible as a very good history book. And, you know, Jim and I were talking the other day that there was a guy in Harvard, Charles William Eliot, who changed the way that undergraduates selected courses. I mean, before Eliot came along, undergraduates were handed the brochure and said, you'll take this stuff. And after he finished his term, it was more electives. And it became, you know, the slow evolution towards, you know, undergraduates picking the courses and picking the direction that they wanted to study as opposed to traditional science. And I wonder if that was the beginning of this division that scientists started straying away from older teachings, older lessons, older research, and, you know, started to go off in this particular direction.
It was kind of like cutting us off from our roots is what it was.
Yeah, and one of the things that happened was, well, if I buy into this, then I've got to listen to these these words or these rules. And I don't want to listen to those rules. I want to develop my own rules. Mm. That make sense?
Yeah, well, of course. And it's if you really want to take it back, that goes back to the fall, because the enemy of our soul has been at work from the very beginning. And you know, he of course, you know, said when he was challenging the woman, and when he was challenging Eve back in the garden, that did God really say that?
Did he really say that?
You know, you shall surely not die. So, you know, he's been at this for a long time, and we like to pick some point in time, you know, past the garden and say, well, that's where it all started. Well, no, it really, that's why I like to teach. I teach a course called the Bookends. And I'll teach Genesis, or at least the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and then I'll hop to Revelation. Because you've got the beginning and the end, and those two tie intimately together. And of course, really? there's some important scripture in between, because you know, Revelation's really just a history book of is just a summary of a lot in the Old Testament. But if you know the start, and you know kind of the course of what man has gone through, and you get up to the great flood of Noah and the reason why that flood took place, then it is a perfect parallel for what is going to happen, you know, in the end times. Because Jesus himself said, even as, you know, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be, you know, right before the Son of Man comes again. So right before his second coming. And how was it, you know, in the days of Noah? If you don't know how it was, if you haven't read, you know, those chapters in Genesis and you haven't studied them, then you don't know what Jesus is saying. I mean, in the Olivet Discourse, where that is, you know, where Jesus, it's recorded by Matthew and by Mark and Luke, you know, he's talking about marriage and
living life
normally. The impression that life is just going on because man is given in marriage, and, you know, and things are just going on. People just are unawares. And there's a part of that which is true. But the other part is that if you go back to Genesis, you find out that man's thoughts were continually evil, continuously evil. That is, he had no good thoughts. And therefore, he was absolutely, completely selfish and had no regards for his fellow man. That's how it's going to be like at the end time. So the two books, you know, fit together quite nicely.
Mm-hmm. And looking around us today.
I would like to take that course. Mm-hmm. That'd be interesting. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Do you have anything published online or anything I can look at? That's an interesting course.
I just finished chapter 13 of Revelation this past Sunday, and I do have my notes up in kind of a Dropbox folder. I don't know if I've got all my Genesis notes up, but anyway, yeah, I should eventually write all of this down, but who has the time?
Well, you're a busy guy, and
you got wine, you got grapes to grow. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, this very is if I did the whole course, it would probably be a whole year, mm-hmm. you know, of pretty much, you know, 50 weeks or mm-hmm. so.
Yeah, wow.
Because of the detail that you know, I go in the various chapters,
it sounds like an ideal thing to put online to for a website to host this thing, and I'm sure there'd be lots of willing people. Anything we can do to help, certainly. We would be willing to do. Dr. Don Clark, again, member of the board at Creation Moments, based in Minnesota. And what's the name of the winery again?
Oh, it's Valle della Pace. Yeah. Valle della Pace. It means Valley of the Peace.
Valley of the Peace.
In Italian.
And I like it.
Valle della Pace, Vineyards and Winery.
Oh, those Texan Italians down there, hard to work. Turning out. Don, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look forward to next Tuesday again. And just so everybody knows, our conversation this morning will be up as a podcast here in a couple of hours at BrokenRoadRadio.com. Don, have a good week. We'll see you.
Oh, okay. You folks do too.
All right. See you, Don.
All right. Good luck.